Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 2010, Anderson Cooper interviewed campaign strategist Steve Schmidt about the decision 2 years earlier to make Sarah Palin the running mate for John McCain on the Republican presidential ticket.
For you, picking Sarah Palin was about winning an election, not necessarily about who's going to be best as vice president.
My job was to give political advice. We needed to do something bold to try to win the race.
If you had it to do over again, would you have her on the ticket?
You don't get to go back in time, Anderson, and have do-overs in life.
Yes, but you can learn from those mistakes, and that's what we're talking about today, what history tells us about what makes a successful choice for a presidential running mate. Is it that home state advantage or what? Joining me are the co-authors of a new book entitled The VP Advantage, How Running Mates Influence Home State Voting in Presidential Elections. In the studio with me, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Mount Vernon Nazarene University, Christopher Devine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And by phone, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania, Kyle Kopko. Welcome, Kyle.
Thank you very much, Ann.
So let's talk about, first of all, in general, what you've learned from your research in terms of whether a running mate even matters that much. Kyle Kopko?
Sure. So whenever we examine this topic using a variety of data sets and data methods in our book, we largely find that vice presidential running mates don't have that much of an influence in their home states or on the national electorate. Now, there are some exceptions to this. What we do find, based on our analysis, is that vice presidential candidates are most likely to deliver a home state advantage in those situations where the running mate comes from a relatively small state and they have a significant amount of elected experience representing the constituents of that state. So they're able to forge these very close bonds with the voters. That allows them to win over their hearts and minds, and that's whenever we're most likely to observe a significant electoral advantage.
So, Chris Devine, that's a pretty narrow set of circumstances, right?
Yeah.
So pretty rarely then.
Yeah, and even consider that for that to actually make a difference, you don't really care about flipping one state. What you care about is flipping the election.
Well, particularly a small state.
Yes, exactly. So by definition, the ones, based on our analysis, that would deliver a home state advantage are ones that have few electoral votes. You know, one like, think of New Hampshire, for instance, would be quite applicable in New Hampshire for electoral votes. It's not going to make much of a difference. Also has to be a competitive state. You know, Delaware is a perfect example of what we're talking about with Joe Biden. By our estimates, he delivered a large home state advantage. Not surprising. It's a homogeneous identity in Delaware. People have a strong affiliation with Biden. He's been their senator for 37 years at that
right.
point.
Not a local politician, but in a small state, even a U.S. senator's local.
Yeah, yeah, the gap between local and state mm-hmm. in a small state like Delaware, it's not much of a gap. Whereas in Ohio, there is a much larger gap. So the chances that you're going to find someone who not only flip a state, but its electoral votes will actually change the outcome of the election, there's very little chance of that happening.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Today we're talking about what advantage, if any, and probably not much, to the vice presidential pick on any given ticket. My guests are the co-authors of a new book. It's called The VP Advantage, How Running Mates Influence Home State Voting in Presidential Elections. You just heard from Christopher Devine. He's an assistant professor of political science at Mount Vernon Nazarene University here in Central Ohio. And also with us by phone, Kyle Kopko. He's an assistant professor of political science at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. So, Kyle Kopko, we're always hearing about Ohio being in play for a vice presidential pick, and nobody ever gets picked. What's that about?
Well, you know, whenever you're picking a running mate like this, there's more than just electoral advantages to consider. You need someone who's going to help you govern. And even before that, someone that has to be out there on the stump with you from day to day has to be a good partner. There has to be rapport with the presidential candidate. All these things are pretty important. A running mate really shouldn't be viewed as kind of this pawn in a game of political chess. This is someone who's a heartbeat away from the presidency. So they have to bring more to the ticket, or at least I should say they should bring more to the ticket than a perceived electoral advantage. And our data just shows that's rarely the case. So beyond that, politicians need to consider who's going to be a good partner in the White House? Because ever since the Carter administration, whenever Walter Mondale was vice president, we see vice presidents playing an increasingly more important role in the day-to-day aspects of governing and trying to get a policy agenda through and legislation through. So, long story short, there might not have been a lot of candidates over the past few decades that appealed to the presidential candidates, someone from Ohio who could help them advance their policy goals and agenda once in the White House.
Do we know, Chris Devine, whether or not this thing they do, it's sort of like a beauty pageant sort of a thing where they either there's leaks from the campaign about who they're looking at. And do they at least want Ohioans to think they're looking at someone from Ohio? Is that in play here a little bit?
They could. It's hard to imagine that working. I mean, let alone someone on the ticket, you know, voting differently because of an Ohio candidate, but to be somehow, you know, to warm up to the ticket because they've at least talked a lot about Ohio. I'm not saying this doesn't happen. I think you could be quite right here. But it's just amazing when you break down the psychology of what they're trying to do sometimes. If they are trying to do these things, they really think voters are quite manipulable if that's something that they're attempting to do. Or even sometimes we'll hear media coverage, for instance, we've seen people, I think of Chuck Todd, for instance, in 2000, we have this quote in the book. We go through some media coverage. We do some content analysis of how the media have talked about the Veep stakes. Chuck Todd, for example, in 2000 said, you know, maybe Al Gore would help him to pick John Kerry as his running mate. It would help him in Ohio, in Pennsylvania. Why Pennsylvania? Kerry's not from there. Well, his wife used to be married to the senator from Pennsylvania, John Hines, and she's the heiress to the Hines ketchup fortune. So therefore, voters in Pennsylvania, may be more likely to vote for the Gore ticket because it includes, you know, this guy who's married to someone who used to be married to the senator from Pennsylvania.
So they're overthinking it a little bit.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's being reflected in the campaigns, but at least in the way, and, you know, in that case, we're talking about Chuck Todd. He's in a National Journal, but I mean, you know, prominent journalists many times who get pretty out there with some of the ideas on what could influence a person, how they vote. And with all these things, I like to stop and think, let's show a little respect to the voters. Would it impact the way that you vote to know that someone, the running mate that you otherwise weren't going to vote for that person's ticket? They may have gone to college in Ohio, or they had a parent who was from Ohio or something like that. I mean, to me, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, you've written that journalists call on the geographic strategy in about 50% of their profiles on potential VP candidates. Kyle Kopko, is it just because it's something to talk about at that point? It's just it's a way, it's a trajectory, it's a portal, something like that.
Well, I think there's some of that. You know, obviously, you need to fill some column space whenever discussing potential running mates. And a lot of times, national reporters might not be familiar with all the state-level accomplishments of various candidates or, you know, various Veep stakes competitors throughout a given election. But then there's also, you know, the Electoral College. People are totally focused on winning certain states in order to secure the White House. So, this is in some ways hardwired into our political thinking. So, you know, I don't want to totally dismiss why reporters do this. I think there's some good reasons why they do it. But as Chris mentioned, it's very good to take a step back and really think about, okay, will a voter actually care about this? Is there a good reason to suspect that just because someone comes from a given state, that's going to totally change the voter's perception? It's going to make them put aside maybe their views on tax policy, economic policy, foreign policy, abortion rights, you name it. But that vice president is from my home state. I'm going to look more favorably on the ticket. By and large, it's probably not going to happen.
How much do they do in terms of polling on this, Chris?
That's a good question. I can't answer that.
They don't talk about it, or
you know, it's so hard to get into the campaigns. How are they making these decisions?
Yeah.
I mean, you heard that response from Steve Schmidt, where 2 years later he gives some insight on it, but even then, not much insight. That's one thing we do in the book, also, as you saw, not just to look at how journalists talk about this.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to just, you know, pile up on journalists, but it's hard to get into. You know, the public discussion, the media discussion, we can get access to, but the private internal campaign discussion is very hard to get access to. The best thing we can do, we try to look at presidential memoirs and how the presidential candidates, people like Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, how did they talk about their selection process for vice president, and did they mention the home state, which they did, but also campaign insiders, campaign operatives. So you look at people, it's never during a campaign.
Yeah.
You'd have to look at what they said beforehand, and we get some juicy quotes from David Axelrod in 2000 where he talks about the home state, you know, long before the Obama campaign, or people like McKinnon talking about it from the Bush campaign later on, or I'm forgetting some of the others that we have in there, where before or after they say things that indicate they believe that there was such an advantage, or for that matter, George W. Bush saying that in 2000, Karen Hughes, one of his top advisors, said, take a good look at Tom Ridge. He's from Pennsylvania. He could deliver that state. So
well,
I
he's
think
also
they
was a moderate,
it.
Too, right? I mean, that was a big deal as well. There's a lot that goes into it.
Yes.
And you know, you mentioned, I think, Kyle Kopko a little earlier, that the job of vice president has changed a lot. They're a lot more important, not just a heartbeat away from the presidency, but actively working with the president, all things being equal. Certainly, we saw that with the George W. Bush candidate presidency with Dick Cheney. Obviously, Joe Biden has been working with and for the president as vice president during the last 6 years or 7 years, I should say. Time flies. Is that changing, Kyle Kopko, how people view their vote on a ticket?
It could. It certainly could in the future. Historically, though, because the vice presidency hasn't been as important as what it is today, voters just haven't been swayed all that much by it. But whenever you think about it, and actually Karl Rove mentioned this in a Wall Street Journal op-ed 4 years ago, that selecting a running mate really is the first presidential decision that a candidate makes. So it provides some information to the voters. It says something about the theme of the campaign, what they hope to do whenever they get into office. And it's certainly possible that as we go further along in future presidential administrations, that it might become a more salient factor. But still, even so, voters, based on our data, and I think this is normatively the case, they're evaluating the presidential candidates. The office of the presidency is still going to be much more powerful. They're the ones that set the agenda. And ultimately, even if the vice president's office does have more power, their primary role will be to help carry out that agenda, which will be established by the president.
And by the way, you did write that there is a home state advantage for a presidential candidate, but not a vice presidential candidate.
That's right.
What do you make of that, Chris?
Yeah, so when people are making the decision to vote for president, by and large, they're making it based on the characteristics of the presidential candidate. To give you some examples with that, people do like home state vice presidential candidates more. When we test, for instance, using a common measure of attitudes, the feeling thermometer, you ask people rate this person on a scale from 0 to 100, you know, from coldest to warmest feelings about this person. Vice presidential candidates do perform significantly better, statistically significantly better, among home state respondents in surveys, as do presidential candidates. The difference is that people in the home state are more likely to vote for a presidential candidate, but not for a vice presidential candidate. So in other words, they do like the vice presidential candidate more if that person comes from their state, or even when we look at demographics from their religious group, or when we look at women voters for Geraldine Ferraro and Sarah Palin, they do like those people more. They just don't vote on that basis. And I think we can all relate to that. How often are you going to vote, change your vote based on who is the running mate? You know, how often does that happen in your lifetime? Maybe in extraordinary circumstances, oftentimes I'll hear people point to Sarah Palin, usually in a negative way, to say that she turned them off from the ticket. You know, so if they're going to affect the vote, it seems like it's most often to hurt. But otherwise, people are going to choose based on the presidential candidate, and the vice president doesn't have enough power once in office, although it's grown over time, to really shape how you vote.
We are talking about what gives anyone running for president an advantage when it comes to who they choose for their vice presidential running mate. We'll return after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about what matters when it comes to picking a vice presidential candidate. In the HBO movie about the nomination of Sarah Palin as running mate to GOP presidential candidate John McCain, his campaign manager, Steve Schmidt, played here by Woody Harrelson, tells Palin, played by Julianne Moore, what the score is.
If he chooses you to be his running mate, you will instantly become one of the most famous people on the planet. Your life will be investigated, manipulated, and you will lose any semblance of privacy.
If you really think I can help this country, then absolutely, I'll do this with you.
Two things are happening in that short conversation. The campaign manager is focused on the campaign, and Sarah Palin is talking about helping the country. And the question is that an either-or proposition? Still with us are the co-authors of a new book that examines the alchemy of choosing a presidential running mate. The book is called The VP Advantage, How Running Mates Influence Home State Voting in Presidential Elections. By phone, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania, Kyle Kopko. Kyle, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Also with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Mount Vernon Nazarene University, Christopher Devine. Chris, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
So a recent headline in the Wall Street Journal announced, well, before I get to that, I want to talk about that dichotomy that I saw or heard in that conversation, Chris, that she's thinking about what's going to be good for the country. She says that. This can be good for the country. He's thinking purely Machiavellian politics at that point. Will ever the two meet? I mean, what when it comes to judging and deciding a vice president, what are voters thinking about?
So, you know, to defend the Schmidt perspective there, I'm not sure I totally want to do that. But if we were to try, if he believes that John McCain would have been much better for the country overall and she would help to get him elected, then sure, those things can meet. You know, I would point out that as much as electoral considerations come up in the discussions of who will be selected, and even as we see from the presidential candidates and the campaign operatives, there are so many factors that go into selection. We do not mean to present the home state as the factor that's determining selection, although we do find that potential candidates from competitive states are more likely to make the short list. We provide some statistical evidence of that. But, you know, if Barack Obama had been looking for a home state advantage or another electoral advantage, why did he choose Joe Biden? Why did George W. Bush pick Dick Cheney? You know, I think there was an electoral component. They were trying to reassure in both of those cases concerned voters who looked at these folks and said Bush and Obama didn't have enough foreign policy experience to really be the commander in chief. When they chose Cheney and Biden respectively, I think that helped to reassure voters. I don't have evidence of that. Mm-hmm. That's something actually we'd be interested in looking into in the
future.
But
it is a big contrast between them in both cases.
Absolutely. And that's one where I guess that would sort of balance the ticket, but in a decisive way, I doubt that. I think that both of those choices were made, whatever you think of Dick Cheney or Joe Biden. I think those probably were choices that were made with some sense of responsibility.
Yeah, you know, Kyle Kopko, I think you guys say that, you know, in the end, voters are looking for who they think is good for the country, who would make a good vice president, whatever that means.
That's right. I think ultimately you need to ask the question, who could serve as president if it was absolutely necessary? As we mentioned before, this individual is going to be a heartbeat away from becoming president of the United States. It's happened many times before in our history. We've even had situations where someone had to be acting president, even for just, you know, a day or so while the president was undergoing a procedure. They need to be able to step in and lead whenever it's absolutely necessary. So I would hope that that's what voters would consider most whenever evaluating these vice presidential candidates.
We're talking about what makes a good vice presidential candidate, what makes a good vice president. Is it that home state advantage? My guests have analyzed that, and they say no, there isn't necessarily a home state advantage when it comes to picking a vice presidential running mate. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page. You can post your question or comment, join the conversation there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. So a recent headline in the Wall Street Journal announced announced this. It said, tensions rise over Republican VP options. In the subhead, it said, advisor Ben Carson says GOP frontrunner Donald Trump could pick a Democrat or an independent. Now, that riled conservatives for sure, but the party establishment must have gone a little bonkers. I mean, are all bets off, Chris Devine, when it comes to this year?
In some ways, yes. I mean, you know, Trump is the least conventional nominee we've had in a major party in recent years. That's why I hesitate when people ask me, who's Trump going to pick for VP? I don't pretend to know. It's hard to know what'll do. I think he will pick a Republican. I think he'll pick someone who's more of an insider. His public comments, he said again and again now when asked about it, that he wants to choose someone with legislative experience, someone who knows how to operate in Washington, D.C., which to me means most likely someone who is a current member of Congress, although could be a former member of Congress, including John Kasich or Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon or some others who have served previously in the Congress. But yeah, I think he will end up staying within fairly conventional bounds, at least because as a candidate in total, he's so unconventional and may want to balance that out. But I don't pretend to be able to predict Donald Trump.
Yeah, looking again for that kind of balance, right, Kyle?
Yes. I think that everything that Chris said is exactly right. If he were to pick someone who's totally outside the mainstream of Republican orthodoxy, there might be some Republican leaders in Congress upset about this. And, you know, this gets at one of the incentives for picking a running mate is to try to foster party unity. That could jeopardize party unity in a situation like that, and that would just add fodder to negative campaign advertisements for the Democrats going into the November election. So it could backfire on the Republican Party if Trump were to pick someone who is an independent or a Democrat as a running mate.
Vince in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Vince.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for the great show. My rough memory, if my rough memory serves me correctly, I vaguely remember that, but Dick Cheney was on the commission or committee, a group of people that were involved in selecting a vice presidential candidate for Mr. Bush. I could be wrong on that. But
I think you're right.
Although the process is quite secretive, as your guests have indicated, I wonder to what degree is there any speculation that Mr. Cheney very strongly promoted himself as the vice president? And I'll get off of here.
Sure. Chris or Kyle, who wants to take a swipe at that?
Kyle, you want to take it?
Sure. Yes, and Dick Cheney was tasked with overseeing the selection process for finding a vice presidential running mate back in 2000. And over time, at least in Bush's memoirs, he says that he himself, Bush, found himself gravitating towards Cheney as a potential running mate. I'm not sure how much that Cheney actually tried to position himself in that manner to become a vice presidential candidate. He openly admitted that there were some issues, particularly with his health, his chronic heart problems, things of that nature. And then even in 2004, Cheney offered to leave the ticket if President Bush felt it would be advantageous for his second term in office. So it's kind of hard to say if Cheney really was positioning him in that manner, but he definitely was intimately involved in the search process, and ultimately Bush selected him.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
A good story that came out of it. Karl Rove told us in that op-ed that Kyle referenced. So Karl Rove was against the Cheney selection, among other things. He felt like he was not going to be helpful in getting elected. He came from Wyoming, wasn't going to deliver many electoral votes, and that wasn't a competitive state and all this. And so
solidly Republican, but other than that, yeah.
Right. So he presented these concerns to George W. Bush, and George W. Bush called him into his office, I believe at the governor's mansion at that time, and called him in for a meeting to present the case on why he should not pick Dick Cheney. Rove arrives for that meeting, and his audience is George W. Bush, as expected, and then unexpectedly, Dick Cheney, sitting there not cracking a smile, according to what Rove tells. Can you imagine that?
Did he actually embark on his explanation of why it would be a bad idea?
Yeah, he presented the full case. He lost, and Bush told him afterwards, I think pretty admirably, at least according to Rove's account, he said, it's your job to figure out the politics. Basically, I'm trying to choose someone who can serve responsibly in office.
Frank in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Frank.
Hey, I was wanting to ask about kind of like, there are some times when it comes to nominating vice presidential candidates that it feels really sort of cynical almost. So, like, when Sarah Palin was nominated, the way I remember it, it was coming right off of the primary where you have Obama and you have Hillary, and they're both kind of milestone candidates. And so it almost felt like it was just like the conservatives coming back and saying, here's our milestone candidate, the first woman vice president. It's almost like when you hear people talk about it, it almost seems like they talk the same way about Latinos now. When conservatives do bad with Latinos, it's like, well, we need to nominate more Latinos because that is what the problem is. And that sort of cynicism turned me off, at least. I don't know if that's a normal candidate.
Yeah, I mean, the word cynicism came up a lot after Sarah Palin was nominated.
Yeah, and even just more broadly with Frank's comment, mm-hmm. I understand that cynicism or that frustration with what seems to be cynicism. It really is. I was referencing this earlier. I find it kind of upsetting the way that people talk about this sometimes, whether it's vice presidential selection or other strategies in the campaign. Now, if you do this, then these people will just follow along. So if you choose Latino candidate, then Latinos will just flock to that campaign as if they can be manipulated so easily. And I think we need to give people a little more credit than that.
Yeah, yeah. Kyle Kapko?
Totally agree. We actually had a piece about this not too long ago in the Washington Post blog, The Monkey Cage, where we used data from the American National Election Studies to examine whether or not, you know, female voters were more likely to vote for Sarah Palin or Geraldine Ferraro, whether Catholic voters were more likely to vote for, say, Sergeant Shriver, Ferraro, Joe Biden, Paul Ryan. And by and large, there was no evidence that these constituency groups were favoring, you know, this vice presidential candidate who hailed from their same group, which again is indicative of the similar finding that we find with home state advantages, leads us to the conclusion that it's mainly presidential candidates that are driving this. And I know there's been some speculation too about potentially having a Latino running mate for Hillary Clinton. Tom Perez's name crops up a fair amount. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Julian Castro. And if the data that we've seen in the past is any indication of what might happen, it's probably unlikely that Latino voters are going to flock to the Democratic ticket specifically because there's a Latino running mate. If anything, it's going to be because of the policy differences between the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates.
But those Latino, correct me if I'm wrong, but those names that have been bandied about of Latinos, they are very accomplished public servants.
Yes, both of them are.
They have a record.
Members of, yes, they're both members of President Obama's cabinet. Julian Castro is the HUD secretary. Tom mm-hmm. Perez is the labor secretary. So they've both had experience working within the White House, seeing what it's like to be there and governing in an executive manner.
Mm-hmm. Frank, thanks a lot for that call. If anyone else has a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Debbie. She says, in 1992, I had decided to vote for Bill Clinton, but when he put Al Gore on the ticket, I decided to get out and actually work on the campaign. It demonstrated Clinton was not afraid to depart from tradition by picking another Southerner, and that he'd be brave enough to make bold decisions if it was best for the country.
That's a wonderful point. I totally appreciate what Debbie's saying there. And in fact, that's one thing we tried to do in the book is not to focus exclusively on the home state advantage as how people vote, mm-hmm. because in campaigns, you really have to consider these indirect effects of not just whether someone, like we see with Donald Trump, a lot of Republicans saying, okay, I'll hold my nose and vote for him. Are they going to volunteer their time? Are they going to donate their money? Because that's also going to influence votes downstream. So the vice presidential pick could have an effect there. We looked at that. We used some other dependent variables and different outcomes to look at whether they differed systematically between home state voters and non-home state voters. So, for instance, we tested not only were they more likely to vote for the ticket with a home state running mate, but also were people in that state more likely to vote at all in the election or to donate money, attend rallies, other forms of participation, were they more likely to care about the election and all that. None of the behaviors differed systematically over time between people who came from the home state or didn't come from the home state. The only difference was home state voters cared more about the election, but it didn't translate into behavior.
Right, exactly. Cared more about the election. Well, what does that even mean? What does it matter at all, Kyle Kopko?
Well, these voters might be paying attention more to what's happening in the news. They might pick up on more nuanced issues that other voters might not. So that might affect their decision calculus to a different degree than non-home state voters. But again, that's not necessarily going to be the result of a vice presidential candidate. A lot of these issues are being driven by debates by the presidential nominees at this macro level nationwide.
You know, Donald Trump in a recent interview said that he was looking for someone with political experience. You've both mentioned that already, someone who could help him get legislation through because he doesn't know how laws are made. But when we talk about someone who would be a good vice president, and we've already talked about Dick Cheney contrasted with George W. Bush. Are we always talking about something relative to the presidential candidate?
Kyle, you want to take that?
Yeah. So I think in some ways it is about being relevant relative to the presidential candidate. You want someone who's going to bring something new to the table, someone who's going to complement the ticket. Now, obviously, that isn't always going to be the case, but I think for the most part, it has played out in that manner, just looking at some of the recent vice presidential picks. And there are some other reasons why a presidential candidate would select a given running mate. And I think the John McCain campaign in 2008 and even Ted Cruz's campaign more recently, I think it is a great example of this. They're wanting to emphasize a campaign theme or message. So at least in McCain's case in 2008, you know, selecting someone like Sarah Palin really helped emphasize that, you know, he is the maverick candidate. He's someone who thinks outside the box. And I think that type of selection was indicative of that. And McCain has said that, you know, even after the 2008 election on numerous occasions. In the case of Carly Fiorina and Ted Cruz, Fiorina was a supporter of Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz marketed himself as someone who is not part of the Washington establishment, someone who fights the quote-unquote Washington cartel. And so by selecting someone like Fiorina, who isn't a politician, someone who's a businesswoman, he's able to present this message of at least conformity with not being part of the Washington establishment, someone who is going to take that same worldview, that same outsider view towards governing.
The idea of John McCain being a maverick, that's understandable. I get that. But then what it morphed into was not maverick. It was reckless. They didn't vet her properly. Mm-hmm. How much has that changed the vetting process now? Or is it changed the idea of going with a relative unknown?
It would be hard for me to speak to how much the process has changed. I imagine that there's just more information available more, I don't know, things get in trouble with. So over time, that probably has intensified. If I could pick up on that theme about the maverick, that mm-hmm. is one of the misunderstood or not significantly enough appreciated factors in the Palin selection is that it wasn't just that she was a woman who could be the running mate and that could provide an advantage, maybe bring over Clinton voters and things like that. It wasn't just that she was conservative, but McCain was trying a nuanced theme in that election of being a maverick, meaning I'm a Republican, but I'm not like George W. Bush, who's not popular right now. And people forget that Palin, her profile as governor of Alaska, was very much an outsider. She defeated the Republican establishment to get elected. She took them on issues involving oil and so on. So to McCain's theme of being a maverick, being not your typical Republican, she actually reinforced that really well. And among other factors, I think that might have been an important one for McCain selecting her, is that if he was trying to push that message, a fairly nuanced message, she was someone who could reinforce that. And indeed, one of the first commercials they came out with was one that was called The Original Mavericks. You may remember that. And it showed the two of them together and emphasized that they're both mavericky, so to speak.
We are talking about what makes a good vice presidential pick or not. We'll get to some emails and some calls when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the relevance of running mates in presidential elections. In 1988, Vice President George H.W. Bush, the Republican Party nominee for the presidency, asked his party to nominate Dan Quayle as his vice presidential running mate. The choice was surprising. Quayle was just 41 and relatively unknown to the party faithful.
My friends, I'm standing here tonight because of the decision made by a great man and a great leader, George Bush.
The Bush-Quayle ticket won the 1988 election over Democrats Michael Dukakis and his running mate, Lloyd Benson. Did Quayle matter? Or was Lloyd Benson part of Dukakis's problem? Still with us are the co-authors of a new book that examines the alchemy of choosing a presidential running mate. The book is called The VP Advantage, How Running Mates Influence Home State Voting in Presidential Elections. By phone, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania, Kyle Kopko. And in the studio, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Mount Vernon Nazarene University, Christopher Devine. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Lloyd Benson stood out in the October 1988 vice presidential debate with Dan Quayle for his famous response to Quayle's comparison of his limited public experience with the late John F. Kennedy. Benson famously responded, "Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy." That phrase is now part of the political lexicon in a way, but neither Benson nor the loser nor Quayle the winner that year are remembered for much of anything else. How much do we recall the vice presidential candidates of yore, particularly if they're losers, Chris?
Well, with Quayle, I don't know if it's fair or not, but not fondly, right? Because the other thing he's remembered for is misspelling potato and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, like any candidate, I think people get too – they caricature
them
too much.
We glom onto the gaffes, right?
Yeah. But, you know, it's fun sometimes. Yeah. but for, you know, for Quayle, I think that's a good example of trying to get, you know, too cute with these selections sometimes and saying like, oh, you know, people see him as the next John Kennedy. And I don't know. I think voters are –
again,
more sophisticated than that.
Once again, yeah. I mean, Kyle Kopko, it's just kind of talking down to voters at that point.
I think so. I think we really have to give voters much more credit than oftentimes what the media and these campaign staffers and advisors give them. They're paying attention to the presidential candidates. They are paying attention to the vice presidential candidates. But at the end of the day, they understand that the presidential candidates are the much more powerful and much more important forces who are going to drive policy and influence governing on a day-to-day basis.
We have an email from Victoria. I wondered about her question as well. She said, I don't know how often a vice president pick wins votes, but I know from conversations that they can cost votes. My dad was inclined to vote for John McCain until Sarah Palin was announced as VP. And way back, Spiro Agnew cost Richard Nixon some votes. Chris, I mean, there's a damage issue. I mean, eventually Sarah Palin was considered damaged.
Yeah,
damaging.
It's very hard to see what benefits you're going to get out of a certain person being the vice president. It's easier sometimes to identify the risks. And for that matter, you know, in general, we're more risk averse. You know, we tend to fear losses more than we get excited about gains. Right. So in that case, someone like Palin could scare people off more than actually help. I do think there's something to be said for, I was mentioning the maverick message, but also, you know, ideology in some of this. For someone like McCain picking Palin or Romney picking Paul Ryan, do these picks help? Well, I think they can be effective at not just shaping a message, but you know, reassuring voters of a certain weakness, at least certain types of voters. So in both those cases, you had candidates who were suspected by a lot of base Republicans of being moderate to liberal Republicans. Well, you know, John McCain wanted to choose Joe Lieberman as his running mate. Suppose he had succeeded with that. He was not able to get it through. That's part of the reason why the vetting was delayed on Palin. if he had done that, I think there are a lot of conservative Republicans who would say, see, I told you so. This guy's not even really a Republican, let alone a conservative. If Romney had picked someone who was more of a moderate, if he picked, I don't know, Tom Ridge or something like that, I think a lot of people would say, see, I told you so. And they either wouldn't vote for him or, like we were talking about earlier, maybe the base of the party would not donate and would not volunteer.
Yeah.
By picking both those people, I think what it showed to them is we take you seriously. Instead of saying, you know what, we can take your votes for granted. We'll be fine if we don't keep you happy with the vice presidential pick. I think it said to them, we fear the consequences of ignoring you within this party, whether it's with this selection or other things. So again, I don't have evidence to back that up. That's speculative, but it's something we plan on looking into in the future. My guess would be that it can be reassuring in those ways to bridge divides in the party.
John in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
In that same vein of negative consequences, as a transplanted Floridian with Rick Scott's being named floated a lot, he's deeply unpopular down there. I mean, can you speak to, I mean, why would they consider picking him, considering he's been such a lightning rod?
Yeah, Kyle Kopko?
Say that again? I missed the question.
Why they would go with a Rick Scott from Florida, where he's very unpopular, why would they do that?
Well, if they do pick someone like Governor Scott, and I know he's come out and said in recent weeks that he would not necessarily be interested in a vice presidential nomination, but if they did select him, I would hope it's because of reasons other than trying to win over Florida. Rick Scott is also someone who has business experience, just like Donald Trump. Maybe they might be able to relate to each other in that manner. Maybe they would share some of the same thought processes, decision-making processes. So that could be one of the reasons why they would consider someone like Rick Scott.
So it wouldn't be, again, it wouldn't be about the home state advantage as much as it would be someone from a big state who gets along with the front, with the top of the ticket.
Well, let me even say this: despite our findings, and mm-hmm. There's still that narrative out there, mm-hmm. And it's still prevalent, and we see it even today during speculation on cable news, online websites, even some campaign staffers. And this is also one of the reasons why John Kasich's name keeps being floated so often as a potential running mate for Trump. There still is that perception. There still is that belief that a running mate could help you do better in a given home state. So I'm sure that it's there to some extent in the thought processes of campaign advisors.
Who have not yet read your book, right? John, thanks a lot. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Chris,
Dave, so, and that brings up an important point. One of the reasons we wrote the book is because we saw this gap between what people were saying about the vice presidential home state advantage in general, not to mention other things having to do with the vice presidential selection. But people would often say, we document this in media coverage and even from presidential candidates, they will explicitly say, everybody knows that the home state advantage doesn't matter anymore. It hasn't mattered since Lyndon Johnson, which we have a whole chapter on, and actually we think that there was not a home state advantage.
Exactly.
But everybody knows it's a convention. It's kind of a sophisticated thing you say. Oh, come on. People who talk about the home state advantage, they don't know what they're talking about. We know it hasn't mattered since then. And then you look at the way they discuss specific selections, and that's what you're referencing before, where we go through these profiles, which you'll often see, and I haven't seen a whole lot of them so far, but I'm sure you will. These breakdowns where it'd be on a website, and you know, whether it's from journalists or political scientists, like Larry Sabato does this, and they'll talk about the pros and cons of the various candidates, and they'll say, well, one pro is this person could bring, you know, Paul Ryan could bring Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We even show a word cloud, for instance, not our original, it's from Slate, but where swing state was one of the most mentioned terms in profiles about Paul Ryan, or for that matter, for Rob Portman. So they say in general, everybody knows that the home state advantage doesn't exist anymore. But then when you talk about specific people, they say, well, he might deliver Ohio. There's this gap there. And I just don't think a lot of people have quite made the connection. I'm not, you know, looking down on this or something like that. I just think there needs to be an intervention where we say, yeah, look, we're talking about it in these terms. Are we really being intellectually consistent here? And do we have evidence to go on? Or do we just throw around these things like, well, this person might help? Might based on what? Based on your perception or based on any evidence that we've been able to use? And hopefully they'll look for some evidence and find a good book on it.
Nina in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nina.
Hi. A lot has been talked about since I dialed in, and it has to do, my statement has to do with John Kasich.
Okay.
And I can't imagine a more qualified person to be vice president. I have no idea whether he would accept the vice presidency, you know, but I'm just wondering if John Kasich would turn down, if he were asked and turned down by mm-hmm. Donald Trump, just how much damage would that be doing, these people turning Trump down and not wanting to run with him? If Kasich, who is, I think, about the best known person that could be, since he ran against Trump and got really close himself, he's finally pretty well known, and he would be the perfect vice president, I think. But I just don't think he will accept it. And
well,
he
said he won't accept it.
I know a lot of people say
right.
that.
Gotcha.
And yeah, but I'm just wondering if Trump keeps getting rejected, how much damage is that going to do? And and Ohio, especially Ohio. I mean, a lot of people think you have to win Ohio if you're going to win, you know, the presidency.
Right, but that's a fallacy. But go ahead.
I don't know. I think that makes a difference. Anyway, I'd like a little more talk about that, please.
Okay. Okay. Well, Nina, thanks. Thanks a lot. Sorry about cutting you off there. I didn't mean to do that. What about that? If he keeps asking for, he keeps putting it out there and people keep rejecting him as they have been, even though he hasn't offered anybody anything yet. What does that do to the power of his candidacy?
Yeah. Bloomberg had a good story on this today that was presenting it as apparently, according to this, that the Trump campaign was pursuing Kasich a little more, or at least wanting to vet him, and that he was resisting that process, and which is kind of surprising because my default position on this is that people who say that they wouldn't accept the vice presidential nomination would not follow through on that. It's something because they don't want that to be used against them, if it comes up for Rob Portman, who is not going to be selected given the competitiveness of his Senate race.
Right.
He says that because, if he were to say, oh, yeah, I'd love to be vice president, then people would say, so you're not committed to the job of being senator. So, we're too hard on candidates for saying that. It makes sense that they would do that kind of thing. Ultimately, I think they'd accept. In Kasich's case, maybe someone like him who is he going to run for anything again? Would he run for Senate in 2018? I wouldn't be surprised if he did. But I've heard others being skeptical of that. If he sees himself being at the end of his career, perhaps his response is he's not afraid of being sanctioned by the party in future elections. So maybe he actually would say no. Other people who see a future in the party, I don't really know if that leads them more towards accepting or declining, depending on what they think is going to happen in this election. But I think if Trump were to be successful and they had refused to jump on board, that might be held against them in future elections.
Kyle Kopko, any thoughts?
This gets back to the party unity question and something that the caller raised. What happens if there's a number of potential vice presidential candidates that keep saying no over and over again? And actually, Politico had a great story on this yesterday. There's already some policy experts that are hesitant to join a potential Trump administration. And a lot depends upon that individual's brand. And I think Chris is exactly right. If John Kasich is planning to pursue future elections, he has marketed himself this past presidential cycle as someone who is very different from Ted Cruz, someone who's very different from Donald Trump, someone who is at least supportive of same-sex marriage to some extent. So he's taken some stances that are different than the other Republicans who are running this election cycle. So depending on his goals there, that's going to affect who he wants to associate himself with, and that could be understandable as to why he refuses to be vetted at this point in time.
Hmm. All right. Well, Nina, thank you very much for that call. We appreciate your time. And when we're just about out of time, but I was wondering, as a parting shot, any predictions? We've got about 30 seconds. Christopher Devine.
Oh, boy. One firm prediction, I don't want to say firm, I don't know, but as firm as I'm going to go, I expect Trump to select a woman as a running mate. And I say that in part because I think the pressure is going to be extraordinary on him from people who are advising him, that with Hillary Clinton running against him and the problems he's had with women, that he's going to need to cope with that through selection. I'm not saying that will work, but I think he'll be pressured to do so.
Kyle Kopko, Christopher Devine took up all the 30 seconds. Christopher Devine, assistant professor of political science at Mount Vernon Nazarene University, and Kyle Kopko, assistant professor of political science at Elizabethtown College. The book they have co-authored, The VP Advantage, How Running Mates Influence Home State Voting in Presidential Elections. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ann.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.